Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
David Falk has negotiated contracts, sneaker deals, and various other lucrative arrangements for Michael Jordan, Patrick Ewing, and various other professional athletes. Now he's written a book. As both Mr. Falk and his most celebrated client, Mr. Jordan, are bald, the book is titled The Bald Truth. Get it? See, it's funny because, well, anyway, it's subtitled Secrets of Success from the Locker Room to the Boardroom. It's safe to say that much of what's in the book is true, because saying any of it is untrue would not only be unsafe but stupid of me, given that Mr. Falk is an attorney. How much of it was secret may be another matter entirely. Anyway, when I had the opportunity to speak with Mr. Falk this week, I began the conversation by asking him about Michael Jordan's assertion in the foreword of the book that Mr. Falk had taught him, quote, the business of sports. What, I wondered, did that mean? What did he teach Michael Jordan?
Well, really, from day one, when you represent a young athlete, I think there are a myriad of important business decisions that a player has to make. In Michael's case, his endorsement career probably equaled his on-the-court career. We had to decide how we were going to market him to corporate America. The first major decision we had to make was whether we were going to aggregate his shoe and apparel under one umbrella, which became Air Jordan, or whether we'd sell it separately. I look at my job more than being a negotiator as being a teacher. Someone has to teach very young individuals who, in Michael's case, hadn't even finished college, how to make prudent business decisions over a long period of time. I look at an individual like Patrick Ewing, who came to Georgetown in 1981. He was born in Jamaica, didn't come to America till he was about 13. English was not his first language. And people used to hold up signs in the Big East Conference when he was the first few years, Patrick Ewing can't read. 20 years later, he was the president of the NBA Players Association, negotiating a $2 billion collective bargaining agreement with David Stern. And when I watched him conduct meetings with the players and frame the issues, I had tears in my eyes, because you watch someone grow as an individual and learn and become more astute in their field, and you'd like to feel that you've had a very small role in helping him, bridge a distance and go from being a player to being a very successful businessman.
Well, you've represented a lot of high-profile athletes, but Michael Jordan achieved a great deal more attention within the basketball world and beyond than, say, Patrick Ewing or Alonzo Mourning, whom you also represented. Was there a specific moment as a relatively young agent at which you could see that Jordan would become more than an exceptionally accomplished basketball player?
Well, I think at the Olympics, prior to Michael's entry to the NBA, the Olympics were held in Los Angeles in 1984. And on a worldwide stage before the greatest athletes in the world, he was like a man among boys. And at that point, I knew that he'd have an opportunity to be a very exciting player. I never realized how transcendent he could become, not only on his team but in his sport, and that he would probably go on to perhaps be the greatest player, in the history of the sport. But you clearly knew early on that he had a very engaging personality, a very electric style of play, and an ability to do some fun things off the court that perhaps hadn't been done before.
Like star in a film with Bugs Bunny.
Absolutely.
Several times in The Bald Truth, you write that Michael Jordan's great strength was his authenticity. That's the word you use over and over again. But what has impressed many people about Michael Jordan is the exceptional care that he and you took to preserve his utterly palatable image for commercial reasons. He took no stands, and he made no apologies for that. Do you see any contradiction between that and what you call authenticity?
Absolutely not. I think that in our society today, people look up to athletes and entertainers because they're celebrities, and they sometimes call upon them to pontificate on a variety of subjects, from, terrorism to international trade to the economy, that they're really not equipped to answer. And because people pay so much attention to their opinion, I think it takes a very mature, intelligent, and confident person like a Michael Jordan to sometimes step away from the microphone and not offer an opinion because he's not an expert in that field.
What are some of the most important distinctions between you and the various other agents operating on behalf of professional athletes today?
Well, I'm at a different point in my career at this point. I think that, because you know, I've been privileged to represent what I would call the best and the brightest over a very long period of time. I think in many areas of our industry, we established a paradigm. You know, as you had mentioned in the introduction, we sold our company in 1998 for well over $100 million. There's a lot of young agents today that are trying to sign, a large roster of players in the hopes of selling it. And I think the environment and the economy today for selling a personal services agency is dramatically different than it was, 10 years ago. I'm trying to set the trends. I think we established a trend of going big. Today, I'm trying to establish a trend of being an ultra boutique. I think in today's environment, a lot of the younger players want much more individualized attention. They now realize what kinds of opportunities exist off the court and off the field, and marketing and movies and music. And you have to have a really hands-on approach to be able to maximize those opportunities. So, but I think the biggest differentiation, the most obvious differentiation, I think, between myself and the field is that, we were fortunate to have the best track record in terms of negotiating contracts and marketing deals. We were in many ways the Warren Buffett of sports management.
I know you still represent some of the people you've been representing for years, Mike Krzyzewski, for example, but tell me about a young player or two whom you've begun to represent more recently.
I went for about 8 years from 1999 till 2007 without signing any new rookies. And then in 2007, I was invited by Coach John Thompson III to meet Jeff Green from Georgetown, who fortunately picked us. And in many ways, I think Jeff has, re-energized my career. He's a tremendous young talent. He's a very, very low-key, intelligent young man. Reminds me in many ways of an Elton Brand or a Juwan Howard or other clients of mine. And I've really enjoyed rolling up my sleeves and getting back into it. This past year, I represented his teammate, Roy Hibbert. And there are a lot of great young players out there who are quality people, but I think that the system that they operate in has been, regretfully, has been corrupted to a very large extent.
Corrupted by the agents or corrupted because the players have been taught by, by media or somebody else to have expectations that are unrealistic?
I think corrupted in many ways. I think that they play way too many games, when they're young outside the high school system. I think allowing, young players to come in the league too early, at a high school or after 1 year of college, I think is a mistake for the business of basketball. The average fan in America doesn't know the players nearly as well when they come out after 1 year as they do in the old days when they watched them in the NCAA tournament and you see a Michael Jordan hitting the winning shot against Georgetown or Patrick Ewing, going mano a mano against Hakeem Olajuwon in the NCAA finals or Grant Hill elevating to make a spectacular dunk and win the title. I think the fans had a much closer connection to the players, 10 or 15 years ago. So I think they come in too early and they don't have the maturity to understand as well the opportunity. Now, there are exceptions, for sure. LeBron James is an exception, but you don't make rules based on the exceptions.
The negotiations that you handled years ago on behalf of Patrick Ewing and Michael Jordan, just to pick two examples, were extremely lucrative, and you maintain that you learned a lot from the process of those negotiations. But can you think of a failure from which you also learned?
Oh, I think the purpose of failures, is to learn. I think, it's senseless to go through the pain of failures without learning. I pointed out in the book perhaps my biggest failure in my career, one of my greatest personal disappointments was with a great, Hall of player just got in the Hall of Fame this past year named Adrian Dantley, who happens to be the godfather of my first child, my first daughter. And Adrian was a star player. He was in Detroit. He was traded to Dallas. Most people credit Isaiah Thomas with engineering that trade, sort of behind the scenes. And he went from a team poised to win an NBA championship to, a team that was in a downslide. And he was very, very unhappy. And we agreed to terminate his contract early, a year early. And a month after we agreed to do that, he broke his leg and never recovered the money. And it was the most embarrassing, humiliating, painful lesson with someone who was a very, very dear friend, someone I had tremendous admiration for, lives here in Washington, D.C. his whole life. I knew his mother, his aunt, his whole family, his wife, his kids. And, you know, it's something that's in my mind, probably in my heart, you know, every day for the last 20 years. And, you know, I've never done that again. And I feel I regret that it had to happen to anyone, certainly to someone, you know, as important in my life as Adrian Dantley.
In 1990, you negotiated what was then the largest contract in NBA history for Danny Ferry. He played for 13 seasons, but he never really lived up to his initial billing, at least according to most people watching the NBA. Was it tough to watch him try to meet the expectations people had of him, in part because of how much he was being paid?
Sure. I think that if I could sort of analogize that, you know, you have a great baseball player named Alex Rodriguez who got $250 million to play baseball. And he admitted that the financial pressures induced him to take steroids when they were, you know, when they were illegal. I think money, you know, the money creates tremendous pressures on the people, particularly to individuals that really care. I mean, some players don't have the same level of caring, and they think the money's owed to him. In Danny's case, he was the son of a former NBA player, Bob Ferry, who was a very, you know, successful general manager here for the Washington Bullets for many years. You know, sure, the money created certain pressures, but, you know, that's my job. My job was to understand in 1990 that he had a very unique bargaining position that may never come along again, and to try to maximize it because the careers of our clients are so short.
Just out of curiosity, what's the most unusual demand one of your clients ever wanted to have included in his contract?
Well, this will probably surprise your audience, but, you know, the players really don't have a good sense of what to include in the contract. You know, they look at the money really by itself, and it's your job to supply the creativity. I met one high school player in my entire career named Darius Miles from East St. Louis, Illinois, in 2000. And I remember I sat down in the living room of his very modest home with his mother and his family, about eight people at the table. I could tell that Darius had a question because what do you do when you're in high school and you have a question? You raise your hand. And out of my very limited peripheral vision, I could see he was raising his hand. So I said, you know, what's on your mind? And he said, do you think you guys can get me into the MTV Rock and Jock, which is sort of like a celebrity basketball game? And I tried really hard not to laugh. I was trying to make a serious presentation. But he was 18 years old. And in his world, that was something that was very, very important to him. It wasn't in his contract. And I always remember that. You know, you realize you're dealing with individuals at a younger and younger age, and their priorities are a little different than your priorities as you get older and older.
In the book, you present a number of guidelines that you call Falk's fundamentals. And among them are say what you mean and mean what you say, stay true to who you are, and remember the golden rule, he who has the gold rules. Did you feel any embarrassment at recycling these aphorisms?
No, because I tried to, you know, I've been in business for 35 years, and just like my clients learned to become business people, you know, I had to learn how to become a successful businessman and, you know, and try to understand what works for me. I used to go to seminars on negotiations and people would tell you, you know, you try this or try this. I think you have to try what fits for you and be true to yourself. I think I told the story in the book. I was invited to meet two very high-profile football players in the mid-'80s from Ohio State, and they had a group of local business people in Columbus that was like a screening committee for these individuals. So I made a presentation, and they told me, hey, your credentials are impeccable, but you're a very passionate guy, and these guys are from a small farm in Ohio. You know, you better dial it back and tone it down, or you're going to blow them out of the water. I said, hey, I'm sorry, like, that's who I am. But they really implored me to, you know, to try to be a little more low-key. So I went to the meeting and tried to basically be something I wasn't, try to be as low-key as I could be. A week later, they called me and told me they had selected another individual. And I asked them why. And they told me the players thought you were too low-key. Now, very few people in my life, Bill, have ever told me that I'm too low-key. I've been called a lot of things. Low-key is not one of them. But, you know, I think you have to go with your best pitch. And if the guy hits you, you know, hits it out of the park, so be it. You know, but you got to try to present who you are. Because under pressure, we all revert to our most common and comfortable behaviors.
David Falk is the author of The Bald Truth, Secrets of Success from the Locker Room to the Boardroom, published by Pocket Books. He joined me from NPR in Washington. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. I enjoyed the questions, and Hope we can do it again.
My conversation with David Falk will be featured in this week's program. I'll also be talking with ESPN's Buster Olney about Alex Rodriguez, Miguel Tejada, and Bud Selig. It sounds as if we're about to play One of These Things Does Not Belong, doesn't it? We'll have a story about the largest ski club in the world, at least according to the members of that ski club, and we'll acknowledge that this weekend NASCAR is underway again, still going fast and turning left. So join us, and remember, you can always hear the program at onlyagame.org.